National Weather Service. A dense fog advisory stays up till 9 a.m. After that, sunny and pleasant, a high of 77. Still fog in the area, now 53 degrees. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. The Morning Show with Greg Berg, up next.
Support for WGTD's Morning Show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. And we welcome you to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. And it's not every day that I get to say I am speaking today with the author of Captain Underpants. And not only that, but a relatively new series for kids as well called Dogman. Dave Pilkey will be well known to any parents out there with young children in the home. And it has been said that Dave Pilkey is the reading savior of the reluctant reader. That is, for a lot of young people who are really not interested in reading much of anything else, they will gladly pick up a Captain Underpants book or a Dogman book. He has quite the ferocious following of young readers and a lot of grateful parents across the country. And I'm excited to be able to speak with Dave Pilkey for the next few minutes, primarily about his newest book in the Dogman series called Dogman, A Tale of Two Kitties. Dave Pilkey, we welcome you to the Morning Show.
Thank you, Greg. Thank you for having me on.
Happy to be talking with you. I think a lot of your fans know, but I suspect some of our other public radio listeners who are tuned into this might not know the interesting story of your background as a youngster and the fact that you had some issues that you were dealing with, and those issues, in a sense, helped spurn you into a writer. Explain what those issues were and the effect that they had on you.
Well, actually, when I was a second grader, I was diagnosed with something they called it extreme hyperactivity. Nowadays, they call it ADHD, but I had that challenge as well as dyslexia, which I still have today. And as a child, it was very isolating for me. My teacher didn't really have the resources that she needed to deal with someone with my kind of challenges. So she just kind of would put me out in the hallway all by myself, and I had nothing else to do out there. So I wanted to stay connected with my classmates, so I began creating stories. And Dogman and Captain Underpants were both characters I created as a second grader to stay connected.
How do you think your ADHD and your dyslexia specifically affected the way you created these stories and the way you create them today? I mean, aside from the fact that they created the circumstances under which you decided to entertain yourself by creating them, but I suspect that there's even more to it in terms of the kind of stories these are. Have you drawn any connections to those conditions, to the way that you like to create stories?
Well, I think I have. I think especially with my dyslexia, my particular type of dyslexia, for me, it's very difficult sometimes when I have a huge block of text, especially a book with page after page of large blocks of text. It can be very overwhelming. So for me, it's always been so much easier to break everything up into small panels. And as a reader, I'm so attracted to graphic novels and to comics because they do that, and it's so much easier to read and comprehend. And that has, of course, influenced my writing style, whether I'm doing graphic novels or sometimes I do something called a hybrid, which is a small block of text and an illustration. And it's a much easier way to communicate a story for me as a child, and I think as a grown-up, but I think it's really great for kids as children a great way for them to read.
So typically, what is the process by which a given Captain Underpants book or given Dogman book takes shape? Because I think when we're looking at something that is so, in a sense at least, simple and geared obviously for children and so on, you're obviously not going to go through precisely the same shaping process as someone who, for instance, is crafting a novel or even crafting a short story for adults? Or is it a similar process?
I'm not sure, because I've never written a book for grown-ups. But for me, I think the idea of getting a story across really starts with the characters. And with the new series, Dogman, that I'm working on, we have the main protagonist, Dogman, who is just, he's basically a cross between a human and a dog, but he's truly ruled by his dog brain. And that's a lot of fun to create a story around someone who really just wants to play and sleep and eat and do all the crazy things that dogs do. But in the newest book, there's also a kitten who has some very complex emotions because he was not exactly planned for or wanted. And so he's dealing with a lot of internal issues, and that's fun to write about as well. It's a challenge, but I think it's something that children can relate to.
Oh, absolutely. I was actually really surprised that there were so many poignant images and poignant pages in Dogman, A Tale of Two Kitties. Do you think very much about the proportion of how much of this should be silly and goofy versus how much of this should be poignant and relatively serious, or do you just kind of go with your gut?
Well, I think it's mostly going with my gut. But I think with Dogman, it started out as a silly series, but one of the things that I enjoy about it is that the two children who are creating this series, they're the same kids from the Captain Underpants books, they are growing up, and so their ideas are getting more and more complex as they get older and as they become inspired by the books that they're reading. Right now they're reading Charles Dickens in their classroom, and you can't read Charles Dickens without some of those ideas rubbing off on you, and they find those same ideas showing up in their artwork.
Right, George and Harold,
who are
supposedly creating, in this case, Dogman, A Tale of Two Kitties.
Right.
I'm especially curious about how a book takes shape in terms of the illustrations. You are responsible for the words, and you're responsible for the drawings as well. How much ends up in the wastebasket? I mean, in terms of rough drafts of the drawing versus what the finished product is, and what do you think about in terms of shaping the books visually?
You know, my process might be different than other people's, but a lot of it comes from pre-planned ideas, and a lot of it happens on the page as I'm doing it. Sometimes from day to day, I'm not really sure what I'm going to be drawing tomorrow. I know where the story needs to go, but sometimes I don't know the immediate details until I'm actually sitting down with my pencil and my paper.
Right. And ultimately, like when you're shaping, let's say, one of these panels with something going on inside of it, does it ultimately matter a lot if Dogman is here or Dogman is there, or how much else we see in the frame, or do you not think about it to that extent?
Actually, it matters quite a lot to me, especially with the panels and knowing my readers. I think my readers are more interested in the emotion and the relationships of these characters, and not so interested really in what's happening in the background, unless those things are funny. But so if you look at a lot of the illustrations that I do, you may not see a whole bunch of detail in the background. You might not notice that there's a book on the table or that there's a special kind of lamp or anything. There might not even be a book or a lamp. There might just be this connection between these two characters, and I think that's what my readers respond to.
Well, they clearly do. I mean, these books fly off the shelves, of course, and not just here in America, but these have been translated, I know, into something like 25 different languages. What is that like to see your books having that kind of a life even beyond our own borders in other languages?
For me, it's the most tremendous experience. I never, you know, as a child, I was just really trying to create these stories so I could connect with the 25 other kids in my classroom. But, you know, just recently I took a tour of the UK, and I've been down to Australia, New Zealand, I've been to Ireland, and to meet kids all over the world who are connecting with these stories is just one of the most phenomenal things I think I've ever experienced.
I want to make sure to ask you about one really fun touch in this book and perhaps in some of the others as well, and that is when you evoke in very limited fashion the fun of the old-fashioned flip books. Explain to our listeners what I'm talking about.
Oh, yes. Flipperama is something that you'll see in Captain Underpants as well as in the Dogman books. And it's a very simple animation technique where you get to a certain action scene in a story, usually an action scene, and you have to flip one page back and forth very quickly and look at two different, slightly different pictures. And if you do it the right way, it looks like a simple cartoon is happening before your eyes, that someone is punching something or somebody is jumping up and down. You see this very, very simple animation form.
Right, but not we're not flipping 15 or 20 or 30 pages, we're flipping two. But for George and Harold, that's about what they can manage with their fliporama.
Yes.
Well, it's just one of many, many charming touches in all of these books, the Captain Underpants series and now the Dogman series, and the most recent, Dogman, A Tale of Two Kitties, which is published by Graphics, which is a division of Scholastic. Dave Pilkey, thank you for all that you've created, and thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about your career. Best wishes to you.
Thank you so much, Greg. It was great talking to you.
You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm so very, very pleased to be able to spend the next few minutes of our morning show with a Cuban-American author by the name of Margarita Engel, who is an award-winning author with an array of beautiful books to her credit, and the most recent of them is called All the Way to Havana, a children's book that is, in a sense, disarmingly simple in the story that it tells, but it is beautifully told and beautifully illustrated, I might add, by Mike Corato. And in it, we are given what amounts really to a rare glimpse into the beauty of Cuba and the Cuba countryside, something that most Americans, of course, do not ever see. And this book also is, in an interesting way, a celebration of the ingenuity and creativity and optimism of the people of Cuba in the face, of course, of all kinds of difficulties and deprivations over the years. And that plays out so beautifully in this particular story of a trip into the city of Havana from the countryside. The book is published by Godwin Books, which is a division of Henry Holt & Company. Again, it is titled All the Way to Havana. And Margarita Engel, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thank you very much.
I want to mention that you are also the Young People's Poet Laureate, and you've won a number of poetry awards. And there certainly is something quite poetic about the way that you tell this story. Ahead of us talking about the book itself, explain to our listeners a little bit about where you come from and your strong connection to the nation of Cuba.
Well, I was actually born and raised in Los Angeles, but my mother is from the town of Trinidad on the south central coast of Cuba. My father's American. And they met when he went to her town to paint after seeing photographs in a National Geographic magazine. They fell in love at first sight and got married without speaking the same language. So I'm definitely hyphenated Cuban-American, one Cuban parent, one American. But I grew up in Los Angeles in the big city, and we spent summers in the countryside and in Trinidad, which is still a small town but was a very small and remote back then. And then, of course, after the what Americans call the Bay of Pigs invasion, travel became impossible. It was restricted by the U.S. Treasury Department for many decades. And I wasn't able to return until 1991 as a writer at that time and to visit relatives. And I've been going back regularly since 1991, so I've seen a lot of the changes and also a lot of the things that haven't changed since then. I wanted to write this book really as a tribute to the perseverance not just of Cubans, but of poor people everywhere who work hard to keep their old things going because they can't afford new things. And I thought that was something universal that children in any community might be able to understand. The word inventar is used constantly in Cuba. Every day, people are inventing things.
Right.
If you look under the hood of one of these American cars, there are going to be Russian parts and homemade parts and duct tape and wire and maybe a piece of cardboard. But, you know, people invent. They do whatever they need to.
They have to. There is no choice. Before we talk about the book, I want to just ask you about the fact that there was this long period of time. If I'm understanding correctly, we're talking about 30 years
yes.
where you were not able to come to Cuba the way you had before. You had spent pretty much every summer of your childhood there until 1960, and of course we kind of know what happened at that point and why it would not be possible until many years later for you to return there. What was it like for those for that period of time where I assume it was either impossible or very, very difficult for you to travel there?
It was surrealistic. Thinking of two countries staying mad at each other for that long is really strange. When you think about it, how could that happen? When I ask children, you know, when I do a school visit, how long do you stay mad at a family member or a neighbor, they say 2 hours. And if they're really pushing it, they might say 2 weeks. But nobody can imagine, you know, more than half a century of shunning a neighbor, which is what the U.S. and Cuba have done to each other. For me, personally, it was surrealistic in the sense that I always felt like I had an invisible twin left behind. The self that I would have been if we stayed in my mother's country instead of my father's, because the last time we were there, we actually did have trouble getting out during the summer of 1960, and so because my mother was still a Cuban citizen. So for me, I had unfinished business, and I had to go back and meet that invisible twin left behind and make her part of me again, be one person again.
Hmm. Wow. This
I don't know if that makes sense to anybody except for someone who's bicultural. A lot of people have told me, oh, yeah, sure, they know they have an invisible twin, too, in whatever country, you know, Germany or Nicaragua or wherever. There's this feeling of someone left behind.
Wow.
And, of course, many relatives were left behind, too.
Of course.
For me, my memories of Cuba were wonderful childhood memories. So I thought of it as a kind of fantasy land. And I knew that couldn't be true because I had relatives leaving as refugees. So my view of it was kind of frozen in time. And that's typical for exiles. And in my case, because I was born in the U.S., it was sort of an inherited exile.
We're speaking with Margarita Engel, and we're talking about her newest book, which is a beautiful children's book called All the Way to Havana. The story, as I touched on in the introduction, is quite simple, and yet it really works out beautifully as the basis for this children's book. It involves a simple trip from the countryside into the city of Havana, a mom and dad and young son. But what complicates what might otherwise seem like a simple journey is car trouble, and the dad in this story needs to open up the hood and see what he can do to get their old car going. Did anything in particular prompt you to create this story? Did it, for instance, spring out of something specific in your own past, your own childhood? or otherwise, what prompted you to think that this would be a fertile idea for a children's book?
Well, my mother's family was poor, and they actually didn't have a car, so it doesn't come directly from anything like that. But because my roots are in the countryside and in the, you know, the smaller towns and rural areas, I love them. I love tropical nature. I wanted to, you know, the illustrator to show the beautiful farmland and so forth. And at the same time, I wanted to write a story that could be read on several levels, depending on the age of the child. A very young child, hopefully, would have an adult reading this to them out loud, and it would be fun just for the fascination of language, which is one of the many beautiful things about poetry, is the way the words sound when you read them out loud, and the rhythm of the language, telling about this family road trip, which I think a lot of kids can identify with, you know, that when you go on a trip, everything changes. And for older kids, the message of perseverance in keeping the car going and the boy helping his dad to fix it. I think that from about second grade on, teachers start to use that word perseverance as long as it is, and children understand it. They say, "I never give up," and they understand that that means the same thing. And then for older, you know, I think it could be used with a child in junior high or high school, for a teenager, or I hope that the message for adults who read it would also touch on the need for peace between the two countries, that we are neighbors, that these are, you know, ordinary, familiar people in many ways, very friendly, and just showing a little slice of family life.
One of the intriguing backstories here is that the illustrator of this book, Mike Curato, who is so well known for his work in illustrating children's books, actually traveled to Cuba and stayed with relatives of yours. Explain to our listeners about his trip to Cuba and maybe the purpose of it. What kinds of things was he looking for, and in what way did that trip to Cuba serve as very specific and important inspiration for the beautiful artwork which he ultimately created for your book?
Well, it really is beautiful, and it's very authentic. What happened is kind of fascinating, because this doesn't ordinarily happen with children's books. Usually the editor coordinates everything, and the author and illustrator don't even meet. But in this case, the editor told me, "Oh, I want him to show, you know, the beautiful colors of the buildings," because she had seen photographs. And I said, "Well, the colors of buildings in Havana are paint in the front, but in the back they're falling down. Where people live, the front is just for tourists to see, but in back where people live, they're actually crumbling. And, you know, every rainstorm brings buildings down. The poverty is kind of hidden." And I only wanted to show an honest view of the country. I didn't want to pretend that those classic cars are collectibles to Cubans. They're not. They're survival. And so Mike wanted to be authentic, and he said, "Well, I have to see that for myself. I want to see the buildings that are painted in front and falling down and back." So I arranged for him to go and stay with my cousins, and they helped him get a car and driver to take him out in the countryside, and he actually went to my mother's hometown. And he just did a beautiful job of showing the authentic city and countryside. I consider him an honorary Cuban now.
He tells us in his illustrator's note that he and his friend, who was his translator, they hired a driver who picked him up in a 1954 Chevy. And this appears to have been, at least to a large extent, the model for the car that is in your story all the way to Havana. Just how common is it for modern-day Cubans to be driving cars that are this old? I mean, more than 50 years old.
Oh, very common, especially in Havana. Now, many of them are used as taxis because tourists do like them, and many are co-owned by groups of people rather than, you know, one family being able to afford to keep the car going. There's such a drastic fuel shortage in Cuba. Venezuela was helping them, but that's been decreased now, that most people out in the countryside depend on horse-drawn vehicles and hitchhiking. So that's why in the story I show people asking for a ride, and the car fills up with neighbors who need a ride because that's typical. There are no new cars that Cubans can afford. My cousin that Mike stayed with is an eye surgeon, and he makes $24 a month. So you can imagine that most people couldn't afford to buy a new car.
Wow. Yes, in your dedication to the book, you talk about the people of Cuba who have lived for more than half a century in poverty and scarcity. And I think what you are trying to help us understand and appreciate is the way in which the people of Cuba have met this kind of relentless challenge of life in such positive fashion. Can you share with us maybe a couple of other ways in which you have seen this to be true?
Well, food has been rationed for more than half a century, and 80% of the food is imported. Agriculture was never diversified. They grew sugarcane under Soviet rule. They grew sugarcane and exchanged it for the other things that they needed. So after the collapse of the Soviet Union, agriculture was just devastating because it wasn't food. You know, you can't live on sugarcane alone. So one of the things that they've done is started little community gardens in the city, and that helps. It's not enough. 80% of the food is still imported, but at least they are able to grow some fruit and vegetables in the city now. That wouldn't have been legal a few years ago. Private business was not legal, so you couldn't have your own private farm and grow food and sell it. You couldn't have a bed and breakfast in your home, which you can now. So many of these things, the small businesses are helping people, but it's always depended on what was allowed, which has been very gradually changing.
Well, it's a beautiful story, and again, so simple and yet so engaging, and it haunts us in the best sense of the word. And Mike Curato's illustrations are absolutely beautiful as well. And they underscore the fact that although maybe we as Americans don't always think of it that way, if and when we think about Cuba at all, that in fact it appears to be an absolutely beautiful country.
Yeah, some very friendly people. And one of the three closest neighbors, you know, along with Mexico and Canada. And so that's one reason that I really love to tell people and remind them that these are neighbors, and neighbors should be friends.
The book again is All the Way to Havana, published by Godwin Books, which is a division of Henry Holt and Company. The author, Margarita Engel, the illustrator, Mike Curato. Margarita Engel, a great pleasure for me to speak with you today, and thank you for writing such a beautiful book that I know many, many people will enjoy. Best wishes to you.
Thank you very much.
You are listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg, and now an interview that comes from The Morning Show archive. I am so excited about the opportunity to speak with W. Bruce Cameron about his novel, A Dog's Purpose, A Novel for Humans. I had heard so much about this bestseller, and now here is the opportunity to speak with its author and to learn a little bit more about this really intriguing idea of a novel written from the perspective and to some extent in the voice of a dog. W. Bruce Cameron might already be familiar to you because of his previous bestseller, 8 Simple Rules for Dating My Teenage Daughter, which eventually was transformed into a hit television series of the same name starring John Ritter. And he is a well-known and award-winning humor columnist, and this latest novel is a very, very special accomplishment indeed. Again, it's called A Dog's Purpose, A Novel for Humans, and W. Bruce Cameron, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Oh, thank you so much. What a great intro. I feel like everything's been said. We might as well just say goodbye.
Oh, I hope not. I have a lot to ask you. And I'll start with what's really quite a basic question, I suppose. To what extent do you come at this as someone who has owned and loved dogs?
Oh, I have always loved dogs. I haven't always owned one. There have been periods of time when I have been without dog, and it's a desolate feeling in some ways. Right now I have a 13-week old puppy rescue named Tucker. We have no idea what his DNA might be like, because he was dropped off at a shelter in a box as a newborn puppy and put with a lactating German Shepherd female to keep him alive until he could be weaned, and then he came to me by way of rescue, and he has ripped everything up within eyesight. As I sit here looking around my living room, I see that he's done a really good job of just ripping everything.
Lovely. And I wonder if we could try to explore the kernel of the idea of trying to write a book which would, in a sense, put you inside the mind of a dog.
Yeah,
and to have you write in that particular voice. Did anything in particular spark that initial idea?
Well, yeah. There's a lot of books out there that have tried to capture, and I think done a good job of capturing how dogs think. But one distinction with A Dog's Purpose, this is a real dog who doesn't understand the full breadth and width of the English language. This is a dog who understands maybe 100 words. Now, the book itself, of course, is written as I'm an author, so I wrote it using more than 100 words. That'd be a pretty boring book if I did. But it's told from the perspective of a dog who can sit at your feet. You can have an entire conversation in front of it, and if you didn't say car ride, the dog didn't really notice anything of interest in your conversation. So the challenge for me was to try to capture that and to capture the joy that dogs bring to everything that happens. In Dog's Purpose, and I should note, I mean, the Dog's Purpose is the story of a dog who is reincarnated several times, and through the course of his lives comes to believe there must be an ultimate purpose to his life. So the story of A Dog's Purpose sort of addresses the question, what if your dog never really dies, with the answer, here's a novel for humans. But during the course of his life, he starts off as a feral dog, cut off from people, alone, and then, you know, we see it as a pretty brutal life. But for a dog, he's joyous regardless of what's happening. So he brings all of that to the conversation, and that was part of it as well. What would it be like to be so full of joy all the time, no matter what's going on?
And you wanted to depict that joy of life in the typical dog in several different arenas. I mean, because dogs can live very different kinds of lives depending on whether or not, first of all, they are owned by anyone or not, and whether or not those owners really care about them or not. And
yes.
And in a sense, you're trying to show us what is always the same about most dogs, even
yes,
given
you know,
all those different possibilities.
Yes, exactly. Even as a feral dog, the dog and a dog's purpose finds himself drawn to people. Doesn't understand the draw, but it is instinctive. They want to be with us. They want to love us. And so his next life, when he's their family pet named Bailey, he comes to meet an 8-year-old boy named Ethan, and the two of them fuse instantly when they see each other, and they fall in love instantly. And so the life of Bailey really helps us see from a dog's eyes what it's like to be with a person and what it's like to meet a person who becomes the centerpiece of your world. Just as so many dogs are loyal to one person or one or two people, this is what happens with the dog Bailey and a dog's purpose.
One of the interesting things about your book at the beginning, before we've even entered the novel itself, is reading the list of acknowledgments. And clearly you have written this book with more than just your own experience as the owner of many dogs through your life.
Yeah,
you have really reached out to people who could really share some bona fide expertise on how a dog thinks and feels. Tell us about that quest to understand more about the mental and emotional lives of dogs and how that specifically informed how you crafted this novel.
That's right. It takes a village to write a Cameron novel. Yeah, I looked at when I set out to write a dog's purpose, very, very often it felt to me like I could look into the eyes of a dog and see an old soul. You know, some dogs seem so wise beyond their species, one might say. But when I started struggling with how do dogs really see the world, I started doing research. I read a lot of different books. Desmond Morris, Michael Crichton come to mind. Temple Grandin, of course. Marty Beckerman, Dina Safiris, and people like that. So I talked to dog trainers, and I became involved with a search and rescue dog website, because during one of the lives in the book, the dog becomes a search and rescue dog and comes to believe during the course of that life, oh, well, this must be my purpose. This is the highest order of a dog, is to be a working dog and to move beyond being a family pet, though in his soul he feels like being a family pet was emotionally the high point of his life. Now he feels like he's serving mankind. So I didn't really know anything about search and rescue, and I read the manual, the search and rescue manual, and I connected with people who were involved in search and rescue. So it took research to do something that sounds pretty easy, which is to just write about life from the viewpoint of a dog. But it actually took quite a bit of concentrated research to get a dog's purpose, to have that authentic voice that I was fortunate enough to hit, so that people like Temple Grandin and Marty Beckerman say, oh, yeah, he got this one right.
That does have to make you feel good, doesn't it?
Oh, you know, as an author, you try, and you don't know if you're going to get it. And you do know you're going to make mistakes. And apparently, I readers are so particular. I've heard from some readers that say, oh, there's a mistake here or a mistake there in a dog's purpose. And, of course, they're right. No work is perfect. But I really think that for a lot of people, emotionally, a dog's purpose really gets that connection, that connection between people and dogs, the sense that true love never really dies.
One of the things that I found really intriguing, and this is as someone who's owned a lot of dogs and fancied that he understood dogs pretty well, but your book really helped me understand the importance of trying to be consistent with dogs, and yet at the same time, in some ways, how impossible it is to be really all that consistent. I mean, that from a dog's point of view, a lot of what we do or say does not really make sense.
Yeah.
And that often we might do things that to our dog might just seem like a terrible mistake we're making. I mean, like putting them in the garage for the first time for the day instead of having them be in the house where they'd always been before. Well, surely that's a mistake that my humans are making, and they're not in a position, are we in a position to convey to them that, no, this is a new way of doing things that we have to do, and this is the new right way of doing things to our dogs. It just seems like a terrible, sad mistake.
Yeah, you know, in a dog's purpose, what we learn is that we are really the center of their universes, and clearly, if the universe were unstable, it would be unhappy for us, and it's unhappy for the dogs. And as you said, it's a great example. Bailey believes, you know, surely wherever they're going, it would be improved by having a dog there. And yet Ethan has to go to school. They adopt the dog over the summer, so Bailey believes, oh, this is what life is like. It's great. I play with my boy every day. And then one day he's locked in the garage and everybody leaves the house and it's completely quiet, and it is just absolutely unfathomable and, frankly, even agony for the dog to be left behind like this. He just doesn't understand. So sure, you know, to the extent possible, if we could just, as humans, be consistent, which I don't think is an attribute of humanity, quite frankly, but if we could be consistent with our animals, it would make it a lot less stressful for them. They're just trying to figure us out. They just want to make us happy.
Exactly. One of the funniest things is when Bailey, as he is called in one of the portions of the book, has managed to get from the garage into the house and caused all kinds of trouble in there while everybody was gone. So when they come back, they are absolutely beside themselves with the mess that has been made. Bailey, Mom called to me sternly. Bad dog, Bailey, the boy said crossly. I was astounded at this false accusation. Bad? I'd been accidentally locked in the garage, but was more than willing to forgive them. Why were they scowling at me like that, shaking their fingers at me? Moments later, I was back in the garage helping the boy, who picked up everything I'd played with and put most of it into the trash container I'd knocked over. Mom came out and sorted through the clothing, taking some into the house with her, but no one praised me for discovering where the items had been hiding. I really love the fact that, I mean, as you said before, you chose to utilize the full range of words at your disposal, but to funnel those words through what might somewhat resemble the perspective of a dog.
Yeah, and Bailey has a really tempestuous relationship with Smokey the cat, who, and this really happened in real life to my daughter's dog and cat. The cat manages to open the cupboard and knock bags of potato chips onto the floor for the dog to rip into. So when the people come home, they don't understand how the dog could possibly have gotten up into the cabinet and gotten the potato chips down, but nonetheless, the evidence is there. And they're scolding the dog. They're saying, you know, even though Smokey the cat gave him the potato chips, they're scolding the dog. Bad dog, Bailey. And he looks at the cat and he thinks, well, Smokey was a bad cat. That's his conclusion.
Absolutely. One very sort of touching moment not long after Bailey has been gathered up by this new family is he realizes how different this experience is from an experience earlier, or let's say in a previous life, when he is just one of a number of dogs in a pound or a shelter. And he is thinking to himself as he plays with Ethan, when I lived in the yard, Senora loved me, but now I realized it was a general love aimed at all the dogs in the pack. She called me Toby, but she didn't say my name the way the boy whispered Bailey, Bailey, Bailey into my ear at night. The boy loved me. We were the center of each other's worlds. Do your experts tell you that it really is possible for a dog to make those kind of distinctions?
You know, that one is just a conclusion I have from having lived with dogs. When I wrote A Dog's Purpose, I kept very much in mind all the dogs that I'd grown up with, and you know, how some of them seemed sort of aloof to me and were much more into my father, who was the center of the family and kind of the center of the dog world, and then my mom had a special dog. I think the dogs do get it when we... We might shower them with affection, but I think a dog does know which one is his person, which one does that dog really bond with, And I think that they are as in tune with us and our emotions. And when you read a dog's purpose, you see how the dog always knows when the people are sad or happy or angry. Even if they're not saying anything, he senses it. He senses when people are afraid. Because that's my observation, that dogs just are so completely in tune with us.
Hmm. One of the things that's striking about how the book opens is that it is this dog being born essentially out in the wild. It's interesting how little we think about what the day-to-day life of a dog like that is like. And of course, for you as a dog owner, you're not necessarily in a position to know that. I mean, obviously none of your own dogs have had that life, or you wouldn't own them. But you seem to have embraced that with such vividness. How did you manage to do that?
Well, my daughter is co-founder of an animal rescue group in Denver, and works a lot with stray dogs, street dogs, feral dogs. And, of course, feral dogs, especially if they've been feral for a long time, they are really fearful. I mean, it's not as if they've been set free and they're living a happy, footloose life. Feral dogs are afraid because they don't have a person, and they, you know, we bred them to be our companions, and when they are cut off from us, it is an unnatural state for them. They're not like cats who can jump back into being hunter killers and survive, scavenging for garbage and living in the streets and being subjected to all the diseases and dangers of a feral life must be awful. And of course, again, the dogs in a dog's purpose are full of joy even under those circumstances. But it was significantly difficult and sort of heartbreaking to write about a dog cut off from people, because that's just not their natural state.
Right. When one of Toby's siblings comes to the shelter or pound, he thinks, as he looks at her in such a sad state, "This was what happened to dogs who tried to live in the world without people. They become beaten down, defeated, starved. Sister was what we all would have become if we had stayed in the culvert."
Yes.
Fortunately, most of this book is a joyous, wonderful affirmation of how wonderful it is to own a dog, of how much they give to us, even as we give so much to them. And it's one of a very few books that have inspired tears. And I want to really heartily endorse this beautifully crafted novel called A Dog's Purpose. And it's written by W. Bruce Cameron, published by Tom Doherty. Bruce Cameron, a great pleasure and honor to speak with you about your wonderful book.
Thank you so much for having me here today.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, it's Nan Calvert paying her monthly visit to the program. With her, an extraordinary young woman from Racine by the name of Shritha Reddy. At the age of, I believe, 11, Shritha took it upon herself to create a nonprofit organization designed to help spread the word about the importance of fresh water and the importance for all of us to play a role in its conservation. She will be joining Nan Calvert on tomorrow's morning show. I am excited about that. I'm excited about Friday's morning show as well. It will include a conversation with Jessica DeBoer, a good friend to the morning show. She is coordinator of the Fine Arts at First series at First United Methodist Church in Kenosha. And their latest season is going to be getting underway very shortly. A recital by a brilliant concert pianist, and it's the first of just a number of free concerts offered by the Fine Arts at First series. I hope you'll make a special point of listening. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. It is archived on our website, wgtd.org. Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto. two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host.